So a bit about Bill. So Bill is a qualified actuary with over 30 years experience across most lines of general insurance. He's held chief underwriter and executive manager roles in product, actuarial, and underwriting functions. He has significant experience in pricing, reserving, underwriting, personal lines, including motor, CTP, home, boat, and travel insurance. Bill has held positions of the chief underwriting officer at Zurich's Covermore business, executive manager pricing and valuation at Suncorp, chief underwriting officer at Allianz Partners. His current role is chief underwriting officer at Pacific International, which is another South African-based insurer that underwrites pet insurance and other specialty insurances directly and through the underwriting agencies. Bill has a keen interest in trying to understand why South African insurers have been so successful in entering the Australian market, and at the same time, while Australian insurers, on the whole, have been abject failures when they expand overseas. Please welcome Bill.
Okay. Yep. Sorry, I'm just done. It's all right. Just give me a second. Oh, yeah, that's right. Okay, good morning. Today I'll take you through my pet insurance journey, a journey that started over 5 years ago. We'll begin with why pet insurance matters to me and step through the Australian market's potential, product design intricacies, pricing, broad insights, marketing considerations, and we'll finish up with innovation and fraud. I couldn't compress all the 85 pages of the paper into a presentation, so if you are interested, there is a bigger paper to this. Let me start with a story. A young couple adopted a rescued greyhound named Charlie. One weekend, Charlie injured his leg and needed urgent surgery. The cost? Over $6,000. With no insurance, the decision was heart-wrenching. On the one hand, borrow the money and go into significant debt and save Charlie, versus choosing the cheaper option of euthanizing Charlie and live with the guilt. Economic euthanasia is a thing in the pet field. I think there's probably a reason why vets have four times the suicide rate of the general population. Vets love animals, and putting down a pet for economic reasons must be heartbreaking. These stories are no longer rare. Pets are family, fur babies. We celebrate their birthdays and share our homes with them. And just like family, we want the best care when they're unwell. Medical advancements in veterinary science now allow pets access to treatments once reserved for humans, and that means cost. These include MRIs, chemotherapy, and advanced surgeries. Pet insurance has emerged as a safety net. Much like health insurance for people, it is becoming essential for providing animals with high-quality care, at the same time safeguarding owners from financial distress. Pet insurance has also had an impact on veterinary outcomes. Being a vet has become a more viable profession, not only from a salary perspective, but also from pet insurance premium commissions. Why this research? There's a number of reasons why I embarked on this research. Firstly, the Australian market is small but growing rapidly and dominated by a few players, most notably Hollard/Petshaw, which holds over 80% of the market, posing as an opportunity for new players. Secondly, the actuarial community has not deeply explored this space. That presents both a challenge and an opportunity. I wanted to create a bit of a reference document or resource for actuaries working in this space. The market is in flux, and unlike mature insurance classes, data is relatively scarce and disparate. Actuaries, including myself, are naturally inclined to model based on what's around us. But for this research, I looked globally with insights from markets like Sweden and the US, which helped shed light on both pricing models and structural differences. As a class, this market is growing, driven by penetration increases into the pet population and as average claims cost increases. And growth is always exciting. What did I learn? Number one, as actuaries, we need to look globally. Don't get anchored on our small Australian market. Number two, one of the most striking and obvious features is the shorter life cycle of pets, which intensifies the age-related premium dynamic. So you're getting really big increases in premium from year to year. Number three, the inflationary effect of insurance has on the market. As more pet owners insure, the system supports more treatments, but the resulting cost spiral, the resulting cost spiral has to be addressed through pricing. We don't have the same controls as we do in the human health system. Australia's pet insurance market is ripe with opportunity. It stands at $1.6 billion and is projected to hit $2.5 billion, and that's just measured in current dollars, so there's no inflation there. Average premiums are $916 per household for dogs, and we've seen a constant increase in premium inflation of about 5 to 10% per annum over 15 years. Growth is coming from two sources, increased number of policies and the rising cost of claims. Policy growth is coming from the fact that there are more pets, particularly post-pandemic, and also the awareness of pet insurance. Pet insurance is a class that's not readily recalled by people or known by people, and as more people find out about it and take it out, that's also increasing the market. From a claims cost perspective, we've got rising vet costs and the expanded treatment options for vets. So there's human-based treatments which are making it into the pet field. Premiums are inflating quickly, impacting affordability for many owners. The challenge for us is to design products that are both sustainable and accessible. Interestingly and strangely, Sweden is the oldest pet insurance market in the world. Insurance for dogs was first sold in 1924, and other countries followed, with the UK in 1947 and the US in 1982. Market share is always a very hard thing to estimate for specialty classes, and I'm sure any of the actuaries in the room, when they've tried to work out market shares, realise that you can do it for big classes of business, like the main classes, but for the smaller ones, it's really challenging. And that's because they're usually grouped into different classes with other businesses. So many estimates come through surveys. And one example of volatility in the estimates of market share appear in my report, and which vary quite considerably, is that for Sweden. Agria, the main insurer there, quotes that they've got a 90% penetration of dogs in that market and a 50% for cats. That's supported by studies which sort of say liability insurance is compulsory for dogs. But then there's these other studies which sort of show different numbers. And this is a US study in 2016, which showed penetration into the pet population was 1% in the US, 25% in the United Kingdom, and 45% in Sweden. So you can see there's a big discrepancy about what people think the market shares are. And I suppose it really highlights how low the US market is, or at least at that point in time. And what do we know about Australia? Our penetration of policies in Australia were 6% in 2019 and were 17% in 2022. So you can see even under those measures, we can see that there's a lot of potential for growth if that penetration goes up. Pet insurance is largely set up like human health insurance, where you've got monthly premiums, and it is hard to get information on retention rates. So, again, searching the world, Trupanion in the US quoted the retention rate of 98%. And part of the reason why that's a monthly retention rate, partly that's also driven by the fact that policies don't cover pre-existing conditions, so you're sort of forced to stay with the same insurer. But if you convert that 98% monthly rate into an annual rate, that's 78.5% annually. And anecdotally, that's pretty similar to Australian players. In terms of confirming the fact that pets are indeed family, a survey found that over 60% of dog and cat owners refer to their pets as a member of their family. I think it's important to understand the implication of this from an insurance perspective. People aren't just insuring an asset. They're actually protecting a member of their family. And as this closeness increases, we can only expect that the market for pet insurance will only expand. In 2022, the dog and cat market totaled 11.7 million animals. That is a significant market potential. Of those, 6.4 million were dogs and 5.3 million were cats. Two-thirds of Australian households have a pet. Of those households who have a pet, there is a high probability that they will have more than one. On average, dog households have 1.3 dogs, while cat households have, on average, 1.6 cats. And if any of you got pets, you might have bought pet insurance online, and you will notice that a lot of players have a discount for a second pet of around 5%. Seeing the likelihood of having multiple pets, it's pretty obvious why people have a multi-product discount. Pet insurance expenditure. In 2022, this survey found there was $1.1 billion in pet insurance expenditure, and that compares to the 4.7 at the top there, which is the total cost on veterinary services. It's a big gap and an indicator of market potential. Also, if anyone's read the paper, I realise I made a mathematical error in my paper, but the conclusions are the same, but the impact is more significant. But for this part, if we use a loss ratio of 55% for pet insurance and we apply that to the premium, we've got $0.65 billion in pet costs that are being paid. That represents only 13% of the total vet costs. So this shows a great market opportunity in increasing the penetration into that market. Some of these reports come from different years. So this one's from 2019. The previous one was 2022. So some of the totals are different. So you've got to allow for growth and all that sort of stuff. This table shows the distribution of vet expenditures by pet type. And you can see dog and cat owners represent 95% of all vet costs. This confirms the bulk of the market sits with dogs and cats. So any pet insurance strategy really needs to focus primarily on dogs and cats. And dog owners are the biggest segment, representing 65% of all vet expenditure. Vet contact is a key opportunity for pet insurance, at least for its promotion. 84% of dog owners have visited the vet in a year, and 68% of cat owners. This high-level interaction with vets shows a great opportunity for promotion and sale of pet insurance through veterinary clinics. I know it must be hard to see behind there. I'm not sure how I can do this differently. Okay. Sourcing pets, if you could see that. Oh, sorry. Just trying to see what's a better strategy. I'll get the roving.
Hello.
This might be better. Can you still hear me? Okay. Sourcing of pets. What we can see here, this is from a study that was done by Pet Plan, or now Pet Cover. And the survey breaks down the sources of where people get their pets from. As you can see here, the two main areas are breeders and adoptions from shelters. So that's showing that's a pretty important area for any marketing efforts. Actually, I better get back up here. the reasons people highlight for not taking up pet insurance, and here it says that 43% of dog owners won't take up pet insurance as they see it's expensive, 33% don't see the value, and I suppose that's a real challenge for the product, is that the cost of the insurance is not being looked at in the context of the benefits that you can get, and that is really protecting yourself from large claims. Also to the right there, it says 25% of Australian dog owners have not looked into or know about pet insurance, and 10% don't know it is available. This lack of awareness continues to be an opportunity to expand the market through advertising. Oops. Let's go to this one. Okay. This table here is basically taking a survey of distributors and just sort of seeing who the insurer is. The market has changed considerably in the last 5 years. Most distribution happens via white label partnerships, supermarkets, pet stores, and even health funds. And going through each of the competitors, we've got Hollard, Petshaw. So maybe I'll move back down here this way. Hollard, Petshaw still dominate. Oh, no, that's not going to work. Hollard, Petshaw still dominate. They started in 1999 and they've got 80 to 85% of the market. Petshaw have got their own license. And they are in the process of transitioning from Hollard to Petshaw for most of their business. So we'll eventually see what pet insurance really performs like through the APRA stats. So that's something that's a bit exciting because it's often hidden in other portfolios. Pet Cover, which merged with Pet Plan in 2021, covers exotic animals, including birds and reptiles, and also has strong representation in the veterinary hospital market. RSEQ, interestingly, has two products. One is integrated into the contents insurance, and the other is a standalone product that's sold directly and through the West Australian Royal Automobile Club. Interestingly, I got some insight that at one time the RSEQ, the 50% of the contents claims were pet claims. So it's almost like they were running a pseudo pet insurer anyway. Guild is an emerging player, having a product designed by the Veterinary Association, also one supermarket player. Pacific International, that's who I work for, has a strong base of pet insurance in the South African market, and it's got a company called Dotshaw over there. And they've been gaining ground recently with online distributors, including Nose, and they've got 23% of the brands in market. Auto & General are a player to watch. They have shown that they can grow in the direct market and also scale product successfully through partnerships in other personal lines classes. The real one I'm really worried about, I suppose, is Trupanion. It's a US pet insurance giant. It's supported through Hollard/Petshaw, and they are one that I think we need to watch in this market. Pet insurance comes in three main types: an accident-only policy, one that covers accident illness, and also you can get full cover with wellness add-ons. Consumers generally choose coverage levels, so it could be budget, premium, silver, gold, whatever you want that way. And they also choose co-insurance levels and excess options. And premiums are usually paid monthly. There's also a lot of different structures. They have sublimits and for certain conditions or annual payouts. And one interesting example just to highlight is the RSEQ limits the number of swallowing episodes per year. So if you've got a pet that's a compulsive swallower, they're not covered. At least they're covered maybe for the first time. Some policies also have death cover and advertising reward benefits for lost pets, and also cover travel cancellation and kenneling as well. Oh, sorry. I must have been on the wrong slide. Oh, no, that's the right slide, yep. Pre-existing conditions and lifetime exclusions. That is, if someone is showing a condition or an animal showing a condition, whether diagnosed or not, before the policy was taken out, they're not covered for life. And here you've got conditions like recurring, seasonal or latent conditions which are in remission or controlled by medication, skin conditions, crucial ligament issues and cancer symptoms. So if you've got a cancer symptom that was showing before you took out the policy, there's no cover ever. The other part is bilateral injuries, which is an interesting one for the pet market. It's basically saying if you've got a condition on one side of the body, we'll treat that like a pre-existing condition because it's likely to happen to the other side of the body. And one example of that is the crucial ligament injury, where it might be in the left leg, and so you're not covered for the right leg. So I think that's something that's pretty unique to pet insurance. Other exclusions around routine care and elective procedures are typically excluded. And for accidental injury, some players will exclude dislocation injuries, ticks and ingestion of foreign objects. this, and for me, this is one that, in my view, means you really need to read your PDS. And I think most people would think these things would be covered. So I think this is a bit of a concerning area. I must admit, accident policies in the US only had a penetration of about 3% of all policies. So it's not a big segment, but I think it could be a segment that gives you a lot of complaints. The other part is very young pets under 8 weeks old, and old pets over 8 or 9 years may not qualify at all. Now I'd like to go through the results of the survey policies for the different distributors. This allows me to show you what the market's characteristics are, to demonstrate what the more dominant features are. Young pets are typically excluded as their immune response is still developing. It takes time for congenital and early life complications to emerge. Their core vaccinations are not complete and effective. Thus, they have a high claim rate in the early stages. 8 weeks tends to be the standard, though, again, Trupanion here has no minimum age, and Petsy is one brand that has a one-week age. Maximum age, most brands have an 8-year maximum age. An 8-year-old manual animal is considered old, and similarly to humans, accumulates illnesses with age. Once your pet reaches the age limit, you generally can't find cover with other insurers, so you're locked into your current insurer. The two levels of maximum age that you see in the table there, where it's got like 8 years/no max or that sort of thing, indicates that the brand has more than one product which has different age limits. Typically, the accident insurance policies tend to have, or accidental injury policies, they don't tend to have an age limit. While the illness policies do have an age limit, so that's a lower limit. Trupanion and PD had a maximum age of 13 years. Like human health insurance, there are waiting periods to avoid anti-selection. For illness typically has a 14 to 30 day waiting period. And waiting periods are often waived for accidental injuries. Dental and cruciate ligament typically have a 6-month waiting period. A 30-day waiting period is the most common. Showing the diversity in this market, Trupanion has a 5-day waiting period for injuries. PD has a 6-month period for dental conditions, hereditary conditions and liability. And Petcover has a 12-month waiting period for brachycephalic obstructive airway syndrome, which is a condition that affects flat-faced dog breeds like pugs. And this slide here just shows the waiting periods for 4 different companies. And I know it's really hard to see on this side of the room. There's a lot of variability here in how they treat the conditions. Like, you can see the logic, though, on some of them. Like, the budget auto and general product has a 2-day waiting period for accident injuries. And that really ensures you aren't taking out policies just so you can claim, so that avoids that anti-selection. They also have a 2-day injury, a 2-day waiting period for injury from snake attack, while the Vet's Choice product doesn't have a waiting period. And PD has a 21-day waiting period for ingestion of foreign objects. So you can see that I think this highlights that the market really hasn't converged on the common practice and the importance of reading your PDS. Co-payments or co-insurance is a very typical characteristic of pet insurance. This ensures customers always have some skin in the game. Plans generally cover 80% of the cover of eligible vet bills, ranging from 60% to 100%. Policies usually have excesses and as well as co-insurance, so that really complicates the understanding of what you're actually getting back from a customer perspective. And I think this table pretty much illustrates it. And I'll read through this for the people on this side of the room. So if you've got a $300 claim, the customer could ultimately get $180 back. And how does that work? Okay, $300, you take off, let's say it was $100 excess, take that off. And then you've got $200 left. And of that $200, there might be, if you chose a 90% co-insurance arrangement, there'll be 10% that comes off. So that's $20 of that. So 100 plus $20, $120. So then the customer pays $180. So this is actually quite tricky and to understand because it's just a lot of steps. So I think it's a real problem with the product, and I think there's some competitors have actually chose one or the other, which I think is a better option. So brands have either a nil excess, and that's relies solely on the co-payment percentage, or have three or more levels of excess. And a nil excess, most players do have a nil excess option. The excess options range from 0, 50, 100, 200. Players like Coles have a single excess of $200. Petcover have a fixed excess of $175 for dogs and $150 for cats. And Trupanion has a fully variable excess. So they, you can choose any level between 0 and 1,000 in $10 increments. And that's why I think Trupanion's actually got some very interesting things within their structures. The annual limit for pet policies is generally between 5,000 and 30,000, with 10,000 and 12,000 being dominant. So they're optional levels that you can choose in the product, so that's why you see all those slashes there. Pet Barn has no annual limit, but they've got per condition limits ranging from 500 to 1,200. Trupanion has no limit, and some products have an annual limit for the policy and a limit per condition ranging from 500 to 2,000. And you can see that variability in policy, and you really, that also makes things complex, and comparing policy is very difficult. In terms of pricing structures, common rating factors for pet insurance can include breed of pet, the deductible level, the co-insurance level, the age, the gender, indoor versus outdoor for cats, and whether the pet is neutered, basically. On this slide, there's a graphic to the right here, and that graphic just gives you a bit of indication of the spread of the market. But this is a US market. I couldn't find a similar one for Australia, but the US market in terms of dogs is split 45% toy or small, 16% medium, 36% large, and 3% giant. I expect the Australian market might be a bit more moved towards medium than toy small, but just because of the apartment living that we have in the US. But it just gives you a bit of a feel for, I suppose, the mix in the market. Where it gets really interesting, I suppose, is that larger breeds of dogs are more susceptible to hip dysplasia, obesity, arthritis, and a weak immune system. And they're more likely to have ticks than small breed dogs. Dangerous, aggressive, and powerful breeds like the Rottweiler and the Pitbull Terrier can easily become injured and have potentially more liability claims. So they can easily injure themselves and obviously easily injure other people. So that's a liability exposure there. Each breed has its specific problems. Cavalier King Charles Spaniels have significant heart problems compared to other breeds, while pugs have eye, ear, skin, upper respiratory problems, and also reproduction problems in females worse than other breeds. And I'll just show you this next slide, which compares how it compares to the average for average across all breeds. And the red box areas are where there's a greater variance. And as you can see, ears are there, eyes are there, neurological, reproductive for female, respiratory and skin are all there, showing that they're significantly worse than the average pet. So it's just really important to understand the specific conditions for pets, especially with all the, I suppose, purebreds or designer breeds. This table shows, based on a sample of quotes, the distribution of dogs by risk level for one competitor in the Australian market. So one thing you can see here on the right side where it says highest risk, you can see there's two sorts of dogs there. There's the flat-faced dogs and also the very big dogs. So you've got that's on the right, and that's what we were sort of expecting from some of the things that we've seen so far. And on the left side mark there, so the low risk, you're seeing the very small dogs, typically like the Chihuahuas and the Pomeranians. The interesting thing here also is that For those who can't see, the low risk dogs are rated at The highest risk dogs are rated at 76%, with the others sort of high risk at 51%, and medium risk at 27%. So just to give you a bit of feel for what the loadings look like for that sample. And this is a US example, and this is a US competitor. They've got 431 breeds, and the loadings range from 0 to 500%. They're significantly different from the Australian loadings, which go up to 76%. Without going into the claims experience, I haven't really found an explanation for this, and maybe some people might have an idea why that is, why there is such a big difference. That's still to be investigated. As in human health, age is an important factor for pet insurance. As pets age, their premiums rise rapidly due to their shorter lifespan. Cats are deemed as adults from the age of two. Cats and dogs are both deemed as adults from the age of two. And they're considered seniors from roughly the age of 9, 10, and 11, that sort of age range. So they do age fairly quickly. This is a pricing table, again, from that same Australian insurer, and it just shows how the premiums increase with age. And this is sort of going from up to a loading of 54% at 8 years. But there was no age rating for accident-only policies. Again, this is a table from the US competitor. And I suppose the comparison basis should be really the 8-year-old level, because that was the highest level on the other one. And they're going up to 122% here compared to the 58% on the Australian player. And here cats actually go up fairly significantly to a loading of 344 at age 13, and dogs up to 233 at age 13. They are significantly different to the Australian rates. And I suppose the question as to why this might be happening, the product structure might be different. There could be deeper discounting on younger pets to get people in. But I haven't reached a conclusion on that yet either. Where your pet lives is very important in terms of as a rating factor. And there's two reasons for that. One is propensity for certain conditions. So you might have skin condition problems in tropical climates, or you might have tick bites in bush areas. And the other thing is you might be living in an expensive area and just things are expensive. You might think of a cost of veterinary practice in a city location could be expected to be high because rental and salary costs are high. You've got wealthier local clientele who demand more care for their pet. And the other thing that might be impacting is that you've got the convenience of some very high and specialist medical services, which compared to some of the suburban and regional areas. So those options are open for your pet and they might be taken more often. This map is from a US study, and it shows two conditions, and it just shows how things vary by geography. The top one is for heartworm and the bottom one is for fleas. And you can see the circled areas there. They just show the difference. They're basically points of contrast, really. So you can see the West Coast is worse for fleas compared to heartworm, while the opposite is true for the upper Midwest. And I think this shows that it's very important to understand some of the conditions that are covered under the policies and just see whether there is any geographical reason for it. So a pet in Queensland versus a pet in Victoria might have quite a different experience just because of climate. Other factors that are also important in pricing include gender. Females tend to be slightly cheaper, though this varies, and it just varies from competitor to competitor. De-sexing is linked to longer lifespan and fewer claims, and so players give discounts for de-sexing. Outdoor cats are considered more risky than indoor cats, so there's a price difference there. Owner's age is something that the RACQ has in its policy, and And again, that might be a proxy for activity or attention to the animal. Working pets are usually excluded from most policies, but those which do have that cover would charge a loading because they see that as high risk, and you can think about that in terms of security dogs and the like. And obviously, deductible and co-insurance really varies, depends on how much participation you want of the insurer to take. Premium breakdown. What insurance ratios could you expect in pet insurance? This chart is actually a US chart, which shows a loss ratio of 60%. Other sources in the US quote something around the 55% mark. And anecdotally, information suggests a similar loss ratio is typical for Australia. So you can expect a loss ratio around that 55% mark. The table below shows a study that I did in 2019 about commission rates in pet insurance. They averaged at about 27%, and the highest commission was over 45%. And that was in 2019. I'm hoping with the more recent customer value pressures that those commission rates would have come down, and because, again, they do have an impact on affordability. Sweden is the oldest and maturest pet insurance market in the world, with the highest penetration. And as I said, it wrote its first dog policy in 1924. I consider that Sweden's Agria product as a global benchmark. Their policies show great breed-specific underwrite within the policy. They've got plastic surgery exclusion and no respiratory cover for flat-faced dogs like pugs and bulldogs. Also, there's the Shar Pei, which is that dog which has a lot of wrinkles and stuff, so that there's no coverage for no eye, ear, or skin conditions. The other thing I thought was quite interesting here is in terms of claims, they say you need pre-approval for certain types of medical scans, and like MRIs, CTs, and scintigraphy, which is it's a gamma scan, and that's where they put a radioactive trace into that they can scan. So it makes a bit of sense there to have those controls because they are quite expensive even for humans. And the other thing I liked about their product is they have all these add-on covers like life insurance for your dog. They've got utility insurance for a working dog. So if your working dog can't perform its duties, you've got insurance for that. They've also got travel insurance in their policy, which covers kenneling and also if you have to interrupt or cancel your trip. And there's also some breeding insurance, which covers things like sterility and stuff like that. I think for me, it was really refreshing to see such a starkly different approach in another market. So it gives us something to learn from in Australia. In terms of marketing today in Australia is really focused on increasing awareness. There's been low awareness, which means low penetration. So that's an opportunity for growth. A lot of the messaging, I suppose, targeting protecting your family to avoid economic euthanasia is likely to be successful. Key customer touch points are breeders, shelters, vets, pet shops, and online retail. Cross-marketing with pet products is an obvious choice, especially in the supermarket channel. Retention rates are high due to the pre-existing lock-in. And in the US, it's interesting, they've got a growing take-up in pet insurance as an employee benefit. I suppose it's a bit correlated like their health insurance benefit that they have, and the question is whether something like that would work in Australia or not. And multi-pet discounts are common as well. Vets are basically the trusted advisor and can uplift purchase likelihood. Some studies say 20%, some studies say 50%. That someone will take out the pet insurance policy. And it's really a great benefit to the clinics because they get more visits, they get a greater spend, they also get referral commissions. Someone did approach me on this one and said, selling into vets doesn't really sound like a very good idea, and it's probably a bit of anti-selection to go where the claim's happening, you know. Like you wouldn't use a smash repairer as a distributor for motor insurance. But I think that's probably mitigated by the fact that if 84% of people are going to a vet anyway, you're not exposing yourself to that much anti-selection. Obviously, the other part of the vet segment is by marketing this and getting more people to have insurance. You're going to have less of those economic euthanasia situations, which will have benefits in terms of mental health for the vets themselves. Innovation, there's lots of interesting innovations. In the pet space, I found these ones, and one was GPS trackers for dogs. That was used to recover lost pets or maybe even stolen pets quickly, so saving on search costs and recovery. The other one was it also monitors the health of a pet, the activity, its exercise levels, and it can compare it across different dogs. And that really helps the owner understand their pet health, and particularly around obesity. And in the US, they give it, at that time, they gave a 20% discount on premiums. The other one is being able to assess pre-existing conditions over video. So you record something on your phone and then you can upload it. I got told this one, but I just don't know which insurer it is. So I haven't been able to track this one down, but if anyone knows, let me know. And the next slide is about fraud. Most of these claims are quite low value. They're effectively a cash settlement. And so the fraud risks are quite significant. There's lots of them as well. Some of the typical types of fraud that you get, I'll read from here. You can get claims for the same breed of pet on a single policy. So someone might have a litter of pugs and you got pug one, pug two, pug three, but they're all called Boris. So they keep on going through. But again, the microchipping is a key fraud control there. There's duplicate or forged vet documents. So you can claim the same vet bill against multiple insurers. Or the other one is basically having just forged documents for treatments that didn't even happen. In terms of pre-existing conditions, there's obviously the waiting period control. This is more in the international markets where claims for pets that never existed. So when you've got a lost or stolen pet, there's some benefits there, and they're being made for pets that don't exist. Obviously, there's always room when there's a lot of cash flowing around of staff fraud, people who understand the system. There's also vets just overcharging excessive or unnecessary fees, but there are some wordings that have things like reasonable and customary charges as a defence there. The biggest danger is really the automation, which is necessary for these type of claims because they're low average size, but that does open up vulnerabilities to rapid high volume fraud attempts. And I suppose this is key, where those sort of AI-driven fraud detection models are pretty key. And just in closing, I find pet insurance a very exciting and growing market. And I like to think that we can apply some of those human health models into this space. I think understanding how different health conditions and veterinary costs vary by geography can improve pricing. Some key challenges for the future is managing future claims inflation with the lack of any, like if you think about our health system, in the human health system, we've got a lot of controls in that system. The pet system does not have those controls. Will it be something like the what's happening in the US, where it's an uncontrolled environment and we end up paying a lot of money because there are no controls? Balancing the affordability with comprehensiveness, so making sure people get cover and not they're just and the price is affordable. How do we handle pre-existing conditions? This is a common complaint area around the world. Affordability in the face of rising costs, how do you make it affordable? And the other part is really making these policies clear to the customer, because at the moment I think there's a lot of differences in the product. They have a lot of the products look the same, but they are very different in what they cover, and you only find out at claim time. And I think co-insurance and excess together is probably a double whammy for confusion. So, yep. But that's all I've got to say today, and thank you.
Thanks, Bill. I'm sure they'll be a useful resource for everyone in the actual space learning about pet insurance. A couple of minutes for questions. So the first one is, you mentioned that Trupanion entering the Australian market was concerning. What are you worried about?
Well, they've got even a small percentage of the US market is a huge market, and I think they've just they still haven't hit their running stride yet. And I'm seeing just some interesting things in their policy. Just their design is quite different from what we have in Australia. And they have chosen not, like, they've got no limit on their benefits. And, like, I think that's a fantastic strategy. Obviously, the cost of that is a question, but yeah, I think they're really more focused on, I think they're more customer focused on what most of the market is.
Okay. And just one from me. So, you showed some stats there on the very steep age curve. So if a customer comes in when the pet's 1 year old, then the insurer kind of has to increase, well, should technically increase the prices year on year very, very steeply. So have you got any insights or in your research, have you found anything what the renewal pricing strategy is for the successful players?
Yeah, this is a big challenge. And you also got the issue about lowballing the entry price as well, which doesn't make things easy to get market share. I think some of the techniques in life insurance could be used, but then where you're sort of setting a price for a longer period of time. But at the moment, the costs are rising fairly steeply, and that's a challenge. Like, you're taking a bit of a risk on the inflation side there.
One more, I think. So the gross margin at around 40% is much higher than human health insurance, which is approximately 15%, but the net margin is similar, 5%. Commission is also fairly similar, so it must be expenses. Why are these so high for pet insurance?
And commission rates, you're saying, or the?
I think they're saying the commission is fairly similar. I'm not sure. Is that accurate?
Oh well, you're saying why the margin's so high in is it the profit margin?
I think they're asking why is the expense ratio higher for pet relative to humans, and if so, why?
I think it depends on the model, because claims management is the key issue there. And if you've got a good claims management system, like if you think about medical, you can just tap your card on your health benefits, and that's quite good. But I think it's also a size thing. The health market's just huge as well. So, yeah, I know it's a hard one.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks, Bill. And round of applause for Bill.
Okay. Thank you.